Seattle's Morning News. It is time to talk about another secession movement. And to do that, Hannah Scott has joined us. Of course, Chris is here. And this is being called Trexit.
It is. This is a pre-filed bill from Republican State Senator Steve O'Bann. He says, you know what? He's not waiting for courts to decide on what's going to happen with I-976 and our car tabs. He's got a bill that he thinks will take care of all of those issues regarding high car tabs that came with SD3. And he calls it Trexit.
So I call this my Trexit bill. Remember Brexit? Britain wanting to get out of the EU with its huge bureaucracy and high tax burden. I think of it as a similar notion. I want Pierce County to be able to exit from the RTA, Sound Transit's Regional Transit Authority, with respect to light rail.
And he's been a longtime critic of Sound Transit, as everyone knows. And with 66%, though, of Pierce County voters approving I-976, O'Bann says there's no question that his constituents are backing this move.
It's clear that Pierce County voters do not see the value of light rail, nor would I expect them to, because I think it's a system designed for Seattle and parts of King County. Probably serves their interests, but certainly doesn't serve the interests of my county. So I want to pull my county out of light rail, essentially out of ST3, still pay for Sounder and Express Bus service. I think people see the value of that, and we had those before ST3.
But when it comes to light rail and ST3, he says Pierce County voters have consistently been clear in their opposition, and not just about the actual car tab tax.
So my bill would basically take Pierce County out, and that would relieve it of the significant car tab tax increase, the sales tax increase, and the new property tax that Pierce Countyans have to pay.
That all came with ST3, and he says he's actually just following a suggestion out of Seattle on this.
The idea, frankly, came from a columnist for the Seattle Times. He was a big Sound Transit proponent, and he said, why do we have to keep messing with Pierce County and Snohomish County when they clearly don't want this light rail? Let's redraw the RTA to basically encompass just King County, and I thought, he's right. So let's do just that. Let's pull Pierce out. And if Snohomish wants to jump on this bill, that's great, too. They can be part of Trexit.
That columnist, of course, was Danny Westneed over at the Seattle Times, who you'll recall absolutely made that recommendation a few days after the November election and the approval of I-976, writing that it's time to cut those two counties out of the light rail project. It's not worth the endless political battling and decades of wasted resources on repeated votes just like that one.
Yeah, except it's only part of Pierce County that's in the project. Only part of King, only part of Snohomish. So how would this Trexit actually work? I mean, if you take the whole county out of it, then you have people who weren't even paying most of those fees dictating to the other people who did want the transit service.
Absolutely. And he just believes on a whole that it doesn't, no matter what, how you divide those counties up, that if Snohomish County, the majority of those voters voted the way that they did, rejecting this, because the vote for I-976 was the entire county.
Right.
So that should allow them to be removed, and especially Pierce County, because they have consistently been against this from the get-go.
Question really is this constitutional? Is this legal? How do you do this with the way the bonds are put together? And then how can you split the hairs over, well, we don't want ST3's light rail, but we really like the ST3 rapid ride and the other things that are non-rail, and we do like Sound Transit's Sounder. I mean, how do you parse things like that? I don't know how you do that.
And I don't know how you do that. And I think what he's saying is he wants to do away with ST3, but the Sounder and all of that is still part of the RTA.
Yeah.
So I'm unclear.
So you're still not going to get $30 tabs.
Nobody's ever going to get $30 tabs, period, regardless of what happens. Remember, it's a little bit more than that. But
I'm curious how the Tacoma business community feels about this, because Tacoma's and the whole of Pierce County has undergone a big resurgence. And I think part of that is because some property owners are betting that light rail will come there eventually. And if it does not, obviously, I'm convinced it will hurt Tacoma economically. I mean, if I was somebody thinking of moving into this area, and you were thinking of buying a place in Tacoma, but you worked in Seattle, light rail make all the difference in that decision.
And absolutely, and I'm sure in the future in Everett as well. And I think there are definitely, remember, 66% of the voters rejected or voted for I-976, and it was 56 for ST3 or something.
Yeah, they voted against ST3.
Right, but in the Sound 56. Transit district
in
itself,
the district, right.
This $30 tab did not pass.
But even as a whole on the county, those numbers indicate that there's still a significant amount of people who do back and do want to have this kind of transit. And I think it is largely necessary with the building up and then the continued growth that we see, and especially in Tacoma, which is growing just like we saw in Seattle just in, over the last decade.
Well, handicap this for us then. I mean, the O'Ban is in Senator Hobbs's district, a Democrat from Lake Stevens who runs the Transportation Committee. He hasn't gotten much luck getting many hearings or getting his word across. I mean, is this even going to go anywhere?
He believes that it could get a hearing, and again, he points to Danny Westneat and being a big proponent of ST3 as having this opinion because these votes keep happening, right? You keep seeing people approve these $30 car tab measures from Tim Iman, and then we end up with the courts and these challenges and all of this uncertainty like we have right now that is going to force this cut of about $500 million in our current transportation budget. It's a problem, and he's saying if all of these voters don't want it, Danny Westneat is, don't want it to be a part of this, then let's just get him out so we don't have this hassle. So I think O'Ban is kind of banking on maybe some Seattle Democrat types having that way of thinking when it comes to session. I don't know that that's absolutely going to happen, though.
And I'd like the last section of his bill the best. And Dave, I think you'll find this a cute Hail Mary. This act is necessary for the immediate preservation of the public peace, health, or safety,
oh, yes,
or support of the state government. What, are we about to riot and have a civil war in Pierce County?
Everything's an emergency.
It's an emergency clause. It's got to take effect right away.
The preservation of the public peace.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
So we'll see. I'll be keeping an eye on it. At this point, I don't know of any hearings scheduled just yet.
I think this is going to be a classic case of be careful what you wish for. Hannah Scott, thanks.
You bet.
Choke points.
Let's go.
2020 is going to be a huge year for I-5 commuters through Joint Base Lewis-McChord. Drivers need to be prepared for moving lanes, lane closures, and some major milestones. But, of course, at the end of the tunnel, brand new lanes, right?
Yeah, brand new lanes and two new brand new overpasses through that area, which will greatly help things out. And for more than a year, I mean, drivers there on I-5 have been dealing with significant disruptions between Thorn Lane, Berkeley Street. The state is widening the freeway there, but to make that happen, they've had to replace the overpasses at both interchanges, and that work is ongoing. If all goes well with the weather, and I know we've got some big X factors out there right now, the new Berkeley overpass could be opening to drivers soon.
The process of getting Berkeley open has to go through three different stages of closures. There is going to be some modifications over starting as early as next week through January into February and potentially into the first part of March to get Berkeley open.
The Washington Department of Transportation's Kara Mitchell says drivers will need to deal with construction closures and detours as the contractor finishes up that work.
I would say end of February, early March, as long as our weather allows us to keep on schedule.
Now, the Berkeley overpass is going to change the game for commuters. And here's why. Because it's going to take drivers up and over the railroad tracks into Tillicum. Right now, because of where the tracks are and where people get off the freeway, when a train goes by, it backs up onto I-5. And creates a problem there. So Mitchell says that's going to be gone with this improvement.
To eliminate those conflicts, do you have an overpass that basically takes you over the rail line and connects to Madigan and connects to Tillicum, it connects to Camp Murray. It really opens things up and gives much more capacity and a lot more movement for commuters.
So as Berkeley prepares to open, the work continues a mile north at Thorn Lane, which is also getting an entirely new overpass, and that's under construction right now as well.
All of the girders for the two new overpasses there have all been installed. The roadway surface for one of the overpasses is completely finished and installed, and they will be working on getting paving on the second overpass here in the coming months.
Mitchell says it should take another 18 months for everything, including the new freeway lanes and auxiliary lanes, to be finished, but it looks like we might actually be driving on them a lot earlier than that.
We won't be able to put final pavement down and final striping down until next summer, but we hope to get everybody into their new lanes of travel by the end of this summer.
So just imagine you're trying to get away for, you know, towards the end of the summer, maybe a last gasp before the start of the school year, and you're going to have a widened I-5 through JBLM.
Amazing.
Which is fabulous. And then that's still not the end of this project. Phase three, the last part, they're going to be adding some capacity to I-5 from the JBLM main gate south down to DuPont. So to add even more capacity to help the traffic thin out as you get down into Nisqually and on into Olympia. So that project's still in the design phase, so no real timeline.
Is that timeline solid despite Initiative 976?
Yeah, I did not see that particular project listed in the DOT Roger Millar's look at what we're trying to put on hold for 6 months. But again, even if that were on hold for 6 months, that project's still in design, right? That further part. As for this stuff going on right now in Olympia, on I-5 through JBLM, that stuff's been contracted, so that stuff's safe.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Let's take a break from the traffic frustrations and snow panic and Middle East tensions. Early morning listeners heard a bit of this interview yesterday, but there's more that I wanted you to hear. It's an interview with Jeff Siddiqui, who I've known for almost 20 years now. He makes his living as a real estate agent. He's also been in the news from time to time as a spokesman for Puget Sound area Muslims, which is how I got to know him back in 2001. But this is not about that. I got a note from Jeff a little while ago, which shocked me because I've always known him to be a healthy and energetic person. And the letter said he had had a heart transplant. And I thought it'd be worthwhile for people to hear what it's like when your heart fails and gets replaced. And I said, you'd be willing to come in and just talk frankly about what that's like. And he said yes.
Literally that morning I was in peak performance. That evening I was in peak performance. And that night, I was being resuscitated by 911.
Wow. It was tachycardia. Your heart just started racing like crazy.
My heart started racing at over 260 beats a minute. And, of course, that meant it wasn't doing anything, and right. So neither was I.
Yeah, and so no warning, no nothing. But they got you in time, and they gave you the paddles. And
well, this was a very interesting experience. They didn't – usually they give you an – I've become quite an expert at the heart issues, involuntarily, I might add. They usually give you a shot before they give you the defibrillator. The shot kind of takes you down under just for about a minute or so, and then they give you the defibrillator, and you get the shock, but you don't notice it.
Yeah.
Well, in this case, I had already passed the threshold where they have time to give a shot. And I remember him saying, I don't have time. And the next thing I knew is like I'd been grabbed and hurled at the side of a concrete wall at 20 miles an hour.
Wow.
Man, it was the biggest kick I've ever imagined. There's nothing you can imagine that compares with it.
Yeah. So like being tased, I guess, huh?
Oh, God, nothing. I would take a taser to that any day.
Yikes. Well, it saved your life, though, huh?
Oh, yeah, it did.
So then at what point did you realize you would have to have a total heart transplant?
I couldn't walk 20, 30 feet without needing to sit down.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty severe. It's decided at a national level. It's not decided by your local doctor. They have a UNOS, UNOS website,
mm-hmm.
where they have all the criteria and they have a list of all the people, no names, just people by region who are on the list for transplants and where they are in seniority and everything. And they call you and that call, you have to have your phone on your person all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they can call you at any time and they did.
How long ago was it now?
It was in August, so...
August.
Yeah. So it wasn't that long
ago. Well, not too long.
No.
I mean, you walked in under your own power today.
Oh, I feel... My doctors have cleared me for everything.
Really?
The only problem now is my immune system is kept at a very suppressed level.
So you don't reject the heart.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it will remain moderately suppressed for the rest of my life. But right now, it's very suppressed.
Ah.
So...
How many pills do you have to take?
Oh, about 40 or so.
40?
A day.
A day?
Yeah.
All at once? Or
no,
paste,
no.
Spread it
about, over? About 17 to 20 in the morning and about 15 to 17 in the at night.
How do you keep them straight?
Oh, God. It's a real job.
Like what happens if you miss one?
Depends on which one you miss.
Oh, gee. Who paid for all this?
Ah.
And what does it cost?
Oh. Just the transplant itself? I'm pretty sure it's up there around $500,000 or so.
Yeah, that's what I would think.
Yeah. And the first time we received a bill for one of their things, it was like $250,000.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you, in this country, you cannot afford to not be insured. We have, and actually the finest medical system in the world, but it's not accessible.
So how much did you have to end up paying?
The $250,000 bill, our share was $250.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I hear people say, I don't need insurance. And I'm very interesting. When I was in the intensive care after my surgery, I asked one of the nurses, I said, what is the age span of people who come here with these heart transplant problems? And she said, well, we see them in their teens and we see them in their 70s.
Could happen anytime.
It could happen anytime.
Because, again, you thought you were perfectly healthy. You had no early warning that this was a problem.
None at all. Yeah. And even if those things don't happen, people can have accidents.
Oh, yeah. Right.
I know people who have had very, very serious life-changing accidents. So, health insurance in this country is not an option. Really isn't.
Yeah. Do you get to meet the family ever?
Well, for the first year, nobody's allowed to connect.
Uh-huh.
Then at the end of the year, you can send a letter. If they respond to it, then you can actually meet. Before that, I'm not told the gender, the age, or even the location from where the heart came. All I know is it was a young person.
So is that something you're going to do?
Absolutely. I want to meet with them. I want to see also, I'm curious, to see if my vision matches the reality.
You have a vision?
I had this flash vision, which was really startling. There were these two women who were in the deepest of sorrows, of agony. And in between them was this person lying, and I couldn't see what the gender of that person was, but his or her eyes were closed. One woman had a violet-purple dress. The other had a brilliant carmine dress. It was a house, not a hospital. And it just flashed, and I opened my eyes, and I mentioned it to the nurse, and she said, well, you've had a lot of drugs.
But it sounds to me like you think this was a scene from the life of the person whose heart you have.
I do believe a little bit in the supernatural.
Uh-huh.
And so there is a possibility, yes.
Well, Jeff, congratulations on being alive.
Thank you.
It couldn't happen to a better person.
Well, I'm grateful for that. Thank you.
Jeff Siddiqui, the full podcast is on the Dave Ross page, Ross Files page at mynorthwest.com.
Your daily dose of kindness now, sponsored by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. Kindness out of Australia. We begin with Lizzo. If you don't know her name, maybe you know her hit songs. Q Sully with a puzzled look on his face. Well, Lizzo is on tour in Australia right now, but is taking a break from her tour to volunteer at a food bank amid historic wildfires there. More uplifting news, U.S. firefighters arrived there this week. They were greeted by applause from Australians who stopped what they were doing at the airport to give a little thank you. Very nice to see all the firefighters marching in to help save Australia. And if you want a little more faith in humanity, just search animal rescue videos. Aussies are doing everything they can to save their most iconic animals, the koalas and the kangaroos. In fact, one 19-year-old used his car to go out on his own and collect injured or threatened koalas.
Doing a little koala rescue. She's a mother with a baby. And I'm cuddling. Just trying to collect as many live ones as we can.
It's an incredible video, too, to see. I don't know if you can see over my shoulder here, Dave, but, the animals are sort of
koala rescue.
Sitting in the car, clinging.
There's a whole family in the car.
She's the mother in the back trunk, cuddling with her baby, one of them clinging to the side of the... So
just trying to collect as many live ones as we can.
It's hard to see, but, sometimes we do. We have a hard time going. Are people all mean to each other, or have we lost our humanity? Just look at these videos, and you'll see that people do still care.
Only about animals, though.
No, I mean, we just had Lizzo volunteering at a food bank, and we have firefighters moving in to try to save homes, so it's not all about the animals. But, certainly the most helpless, the animals, the children among us, we really do rally and come together as humans to help each other.
It's time for the Sports Insider, and here she is from 710 ESPN Seattle, Stacey Rostow. Tom, Jake, and Stacey. So we get to see Jimmy Graham play again. Now, Jimmy Graham was supposed to be the Seahawks' pass magnet. It never quite worked out. What's his performance been with Green Bay?
He hasn't been as effective in Green Bay as he was with Seattle. So I think that people have this memory of Jimmy Graham in Seattle, like he just never got any attention. He was their second leading receiver behind Doug Baldwin through most of his time here, with the exception, obviously, of 2015 when he was injured with that patellar tendon rupture. So I tend to be kind of a Jimmy Graham apologist. I just think that he was not used well. He wasn't. It was an offensive scheme issue and not a Jimmy Graham issue. He was used entirely differently in New Orleans. He was basically a receiver there, wasn't asked to block a lot. I think the idea was that would change in Green Bay. Maybe he'd be used similarly to New Orleans. He hasn't really been. And that's been partly scheme issues there, where he hasn't had a game over probably 80 yards. He hasn't had any 100 receiving yard game, which wouldn't be weird for a tight end. It's weird for a tight end of Jimmy Graham's caliber. So he hasn't had a stellar season with Green Bay.
Mm. And so Lambeau Field, I know, has this stereotype of being a frozen tundra, and it's going to be in the low 20s on Sunday when the Seahawks are there. Do you know how the team, or do they, prepare for this type of climate? Do they go into maybe like oversized freezers and run some drills in there to I don't know. What do they do?
We're just playing in the fridge. They're leaving the windows and doors at the VMAC. So the indoor field at VMAC is just this big. It's already pretty cold. Like, we've gone in there for press conferences. I don't know why. It already feels like a fridge. They're leaving the doors open, having fans blow in cold air. Oh. Thankfully for them, Seattle's pretty cold already right now. I don't know about you guys. I'm freezing all the time. So they're preparing that way. And don't forget, I think that because of Seattle's history in Green Bay, people are wondering how the team is going to play in cold weather. They did beat the Vikings in -6 degrees, one of the coldest playoff games on record. So they've had success in cold games. They just haven't had success at Lambeau.
I think the whole idea of home field advantage, I think, it was turned on its head this season. So I have no doubt that the worse the weather is, the better the Hawks will probably do, provided that they can go in healthy. So what's the injury report?
So the injury report looks pretty crowded. However, it's not as bad as it looks. So you got about 80% of your offensive line on there. Starting center Joey Hunt, for instance, is listed. He's been listed with the same injury for a couple weeks and has played. George Fant has also been on the injury report for a couple weeks and has played. So I wouldn't worry about any of the offensive linemen yet, with the exception of Dwayne Brown and Mike Iupati, both of whom have been out. So the question isn't whether they'll return from last week. It's whether they can make it back to start from their injury. So Mike Iupati, I think, is a little more of a long shot than Dwayne Brown. Both are going to be questionable. Otherwise, the injury report should be pretty encouraging. You have Quandre Diggs, who wasn't even listed, which is great news. You have Clowney and Ansah, who are limited. So I would pay attention for fans to Pete Carroll's comments on Friday.
Okay, but now you said, I thought that Clowney was on for Sunday.
You mean on the injury report?
No, that he was good to go on for Sunday. Now you're saying he's limited. What does that mean exactly?
Our understanding is he's good to go for Sunday. The thing is, his injury is this chronic injury that he's going to be dealing with for however long they go into the playoffs. So you shouldn't be surprised at all if he's listed on the injury report as limited or out. That's exactly how they treated him last week, and then he played Sunday.
Oh, I see. So you can be you can be on the injured list but still be put in the game? What? I don't get that. I don't get it.
Yeah, you can't be declared out on Friday for the final injury report, but there have been many times, Dwayne Brown, for instance, when he was dealing with a knee injury and a bicep injury early this year, would go almost the entire week without practicing and then play Sunday.
I see. So he's on the injury report, on injury list for the purposes of not practicing.
But yes.
They can give him a couple aspirin and put him in the game, huh?
Exactly. Aspirin. Yeah. Aspirin.
Take the needle, baby.
Oh, I don't want to hear that. All right, Stacy, thank you very much. So how is the cafeteria food in your elementary school? It was probably a long way from what kids in the Seattle School District will eat today, as we hear from Rachel Bell, brought to you by Clipper Vacations.
Rock, paper, scissors, shoot. Rock, paper, scissors, shoot.
It's lunchtime at Greenwood Elementary School in Seattle.
We have veggie burgers, or we have brisket with baby potatoes, beef gravy, and rolls.
Over the past year, the lunch menus at Seattle schools have been slowly evolving. Fewer processed foods, more vegetarian options, and meals that appeal to the heritages of the children in a particular part of town. And that's all thanks to Aaron Smith, the district's new director of nutritional services, who moved here last year from Chicago.
Student palates are a lot more sophisticated than what I expected it to be. Some of the things that kids ask for just kind of blows my mind, you know, like sushi, like sriracha, and chicken tinga. It makes it really fun because they're asking for things they eat at home, things that their mom cooked for them. Students are pushing us to do better.
Smith observed that students in South Seattle can eat differently than students in North Seattle. So why should there only be one menu for the whole district? He's divided the district into five quadrants and is currently surveying the kids on what they like to eat.
In the West, it's a really high like Somali population that we've been working with. The South really likes more Southern style food. Central is a lot of Asian type cuisines.
When kids requested more vegan or vegetarian options, Smith put in some new orders from their food vendors and invited a group of kids to the cafeteria to taste the dishes and vote on what they like best.
Our number one customer is the students, and so they definitely should have a voice, and their parents should have a voice in what they would like for their kids to eat. The biggest hit has been the tamales. We have a really authentic tamale within a corn husk. The pot stickers went over really well.
And he doesn't want to just serve kids the classic kid foods. Processed chicken nuggets, mac and cheese. He wants them to eat food that adults eat.
Chicken has bones. So we want to go away from processed items to natural product. So we brought in actual chicken legs. We still have chicken nuggets on the menu, but it's actually a whole muscle natural product. So it's like a chicken breast chunk instead of the processed one you might see at a fast food restaurant. Same thing with the chicken sandwiches. It's a whole muscle natural product. And we're looking at bringing in actual chicken wings and other parts like breasts and thighs. Yeah, chicken has bones.
Fifth grader Corbin Fichter doesn't eat any bones. He's a vegetarian and a fan of school lunch.
I'd say it's pretty healthy. I mean, you always have to get at least one thing from the salad bar. Mm-hmm. It's pretty healthy.
10-year-old Corbin is pretty aware of what he eats. He decided to go vegetarian last year after watching a YouTube video.
Well, I honestly heard about slaughterhouses once, and I thought the name was really dark. Thought I would learn something about them, and well, then I looked it up on YouTube. That's a really dark place to go.
Corbin had a veggie burger that day for lunch, but other kids had the option of meat. There were slices of tender smoked brisket, so delicious that it was honestly better than any barbecue restaurant I have tried in Washington State. And the tiny roasted potatoes that came with it were perfect. The potato skin snapped when you took a bite, and the centers were super creamy. I also tried edamame lemongrass pot stickers, a fillet of wild-caught Alaskan salmon, a tamale, and duck egg rolls that will be served to celebrate Chinese New Year. When you think of school cafeteria lunch, you don't think of food like this. It was honestly delicious. Almost too delicious for an elementary school cafeteria.
No, we hear all the time, like, how do you put brisket on the menu? That's too fancy for kids. And it's food, you know? Yeah. Their palate is way more sophisticated than what most adults think.
Smith has been adding one new menu item a month, and he plans to serve elementary, middle, and high school students different menus since their palates change as they get older.
We're the Greenwood Stars, and we always...
To see a picture of all the foods I tried at Greenwood Elementary School, go to mynorthwest.com/Rachel Bell.
And young Corbin will be a Jeopardy champion in about, 10, 15 years.
The one who was answering the question the slaughterhouse? Yeah. Poor thing to have to learn the truth so soon.
Oh, well. It is 8:53, says the former vegan.
Vegetarian. For 5 years. Yeah. Now, my daughter, who's six, she's saying she doesn't want to eat meat anymore. So now she's sussing out what is actually meat. Like, I had to tell her, like, well, bacon is meat. She was like, oh.
Oh.
But she's trying.
Did you describe where it comes from?
Yeah, she knows where all the meat comes from.
Wow.
She's been out fishing. She, you know, so we try to give her the reality. Just we don't show her videos of slaughterhouses. Gee.
Yeah. Next step, a hunting trip coming. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthwest.com.